Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. We're going to be focusing today on the critical care environment from the perspective of a critical care nurse practitioner. I'd like you to meet Kenyetta Christmas, who is my guest today, as we go behind those doors into the ICU and we take a look at how the critical care unit functions and some of the challenges associated with being in that environment. Be sure to listen to Amy McCutcheon's podcast, which was probably a week or so before the one you're hearing today. She shares her perspective as a critical care staff nurse. Kenyetta is a critical care nurse practitioner. And for the sake of our listener who is not clear on that role, can you tell our audience, first of all, welcome, Kenyetta. I'm jumping right in without giving you a chance to say hello. That's rude.
Thank you, Pat. I'm glad to be here. But we can jump right in.
All right. Well, you're used to fast action for sure. The nurse practitioner.
So nurse practitioners here in the U.S., we're nurses. You start out with an undergraduate nursing degree, and then you advance your education by earning a master's degree in nursing and sit for board certification as a nurse practitioner. There are various types of nurse practitioners within the nursing field. I particularly are what we call an acute care nurse practitioner, where my specialty is based on acute illnesses and more so in an inpatient or specialty setting. In the NP role in the critical care setting can vary from location or state to state, but ultimately it is day-to-day management with physicians of critically ill patients.
When I first started supplying expert witnesses, Kenyetta, I had a category in my database called nurse practitioner. And then by the time I sold my company, I had probably 20 different types of nurse practitioner contacts who were experts, from orthopedic to trauma to cardiology to geriatric to family practice, OBGYN, critical care, surgical, neurosurgical. The list was quite extensive. I think one of the things that I realized is that when I got my master's degree, I majored in education and I minored in patient teaching and diabetes. The year that I finished my master's program at University of Pennsylvania, they switched over to a nurse practitioner program and then poured all their resources into preparing nurse practitioners. What have you seen in the time that you've been involved in the field as a nurse practitioner in terms of the increased numbers of nurses who seek that type of education?
There, in some regions, is what one may say an oversaturation of nurse practitioners. I think that primarily hospital-based and ICU-based nurses want to get away from the bedside for various reasons. And a lot of them look towards nurse practitioners programs and CRNA programs. And you can have a large influx of nurses completing graduate school for NP, but not enough positions. And I think it's a desirable field. The programs are, some are very rigorous, some may be slightly easier to get into, but there just aren't a lot of positions. So you can come out and have a difficult time finding a job as a nurse practitioner.
And now, when you came out, did you go directly into a critical care environment as a nurse practitioner?
I did. I started, I've been a nurse since 2003. And I started at the bedside at a level one trauma center in the critical care environment. We had open ICUs, so it was trauma, cardiothoracic surgery, cardiology, neuro, kind of all meshed together in various units. And so I did that for about 5 years before I went to get my master's. And then when I came out, I went straight into a trauma position, working as a trauma NP. And I did that for a while. And then I finally settled into more medical critical care based position, which I've been in now for level 13 years.
I don't think that I have ever seen a hospital setting where the patients were all blended together. I've seen a model where there's the neuro ICU and the cardiac ICU and the surgical ICU. I would think from the educational perspective, not knowing anything about the setting in which you worked, since I spent 7 years of my life after I got my master's teaching nurses in an acute care hospital, I would think that that would be much more challenging in terms of the knowledge base of the critical care nurses if they had to know all of those areas and be fluent in all those areas in order to take care of their patients. Was that a point that you ran into at all?
It could be very challenging. And that model rarely exists now. It just happens that the hospital where I started when I got out of school was an inner city hospital. And, you know, the units were all open to each other. They were sectioned off, but the patients just blended. So it was wherever there was a bed, that's the type of patient that went in the bed. And so it can be difficult to learn more than one specialty, but I personally took it as a benefit because I do now know more than one specialty. And as I progressed in my nursing career, I kind of did hone in to more of medical, surgical, critical care based, but it kind of gave me a broader background.
Now we've got you as a nurse practitioner in the critical care unit. How is your role different now than when you were a staff nurse?
The level of stress, I would say, is a little bit higher. And my management is different. You think differently as a nurse practitioner than a nurse. And it's a lot of prioritizing and juggling more than one thing at one time. You know, typically as a staff nurse, you may have your one, two, sometimes three patients that you're focused on, while I can have a unit up to 14 patients. Or, you know, now with COVID, our numbers are skyrocketing, so we can have ICUs that are completely full with patients holding in other parts of the hospital, such as the ER, waiting on an ICU bed.
Would you be seeing them in the ER, or would there be an ER critical care or ER nurse practitioner involved in that patient's care?
They would, once we are contacted to admit the patient for critical care services, it falls under our umbrella, regardless of where they are in the hospital. So even though they may be sitting in the ER, it is still my responsibility or my team responsibility for the patient. So the ER nurses will call us instead of the ER physician if there were issues.
Okay. When you say my team, who is on your team?
My current practices that I work at, we're a fairly large team. There's 28 of us.
28 critical care nurse practitioners?
Holy cow. We're a very large team.
Whoa.
And we have well over 50-something physicians.
Holy cow.
Yeah. We practice out of more than one hospital, too.
Okay.
So hence is why our group is so large.
There was an intensivist who used to screen cases for me from Merit, and I know he was working in a hospital in New York State, and he was one of three intensivists. And he was so pleased when he was able to move the team from him and another doctor to him and two other doctors. So I'm thinking, oh, you got a lot of physicians.
Yeah, we have a very large practice. Our practice is currently kind of divided into two halves, one half that is kind of straight pulmonary and then one half that is critical care. So we don't necessarily cross sections per se, but it is a very large practice with a lot of physicians and a lot of advanced practitioners.
Which would then, in my mind, raise challenges with communication. How do you keep everybody focused and informed?
Once we're on unit for that week, the AP or the advanced practitioner, we call them APPs in my system, you stay in one unit for the week. So we run a physician NP pair per ICU. So you're there for the week with the physician. Our schedules kind of alternate so that someone coming on kind of always knows the entire unit. But it's easier that way instead of bouncing between multiple units. You're kind of honed into your one unit for the week. But our next work week, you may be in another unit, but nevertheless, you're in one place for the entire time you're on the schedule.
Okay. Our listeners are legal nurse consultants or nurses interested in legal nurse consulting. And I know that they are fascinated by wanting to know what can go wrong. We just talked about the importance of communication and stability so that you get to know the patients. What are the kinds of risks that you see or the things that put you on high alert as a critical care NP?
The patients are quite complex. They are very complex and hemodynamics can shift at any given point in time. This is even pre-COVID, you can be dealing with multi-system organ failure. You know, most common things that we see are sepsis, septic shock, post-surgical patients. And sometimes you can be managing patients who are on like up to 5, 6, 7 drips at a time. And you're managing complicated vent settings for oxygenation, and you're managing acidosis, and then they're on dialysis. So the patients are quite complex. And so it can be a lot that you have to hone to very quickly in this role.
And what about the risks associated with those drips and medication errors that can occur in a critical care setting? What are some of the types of errors that could occur?
Most common ones tend to be associated with the IV medications. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of high alert medications in this arena, of course. Vasopressors are the biggest. You can have patients on 3 to 4 vasopressors at a time that require very tedious titrations. Each set of vasopressors has a different set of side effect profiles. If you have a low EF, we have to consider which pressure should we start first versus another one. You know, do you need chronotropic support? And then how will that play? Some pressors can tend to give you arrhythmias. So if that's a factor, we have to play into that. So it's a lot of making sure you order the correct medicine at the correct doses. A lot of times, because these patients are on high amount of drips, they're getting a lot of volume. And most often, renal failure is quite common in the ICU setting. So you have to worry about the amount of intake. So sometimes the pressors are double dosed or quad strength, which the medicines are more potent, and therefore the titration and the rates are different. So you have to be very careful if you're ordering, you know, quad strength Levofid, for example, that when the nurses program the pump, is programmed appropriately so that the patient gets the correct doses based off compared to single strength Levofid. Other high alert medications I would say include insulin. We run a lot of insulin drips, whether it's intensive insulin for management of just hyperglycemia or insulin drips for DKA or HHMK, it is a high alert medication. And so it is has to be carefully watched, and the dosing has to be carefully titrated. I think other more common ones would also be heparin drips. Mm-hmm. There are heparin concentrations that are a bit different. If you're managing a heparin drip, say for a DVT-PE, the dosing is different compared to if you're managing a heparin drip, say for AFib, or a heparin drip for neuro protocol. So that too is a very high alert medication. Sometimes some things that tend to forget is patients' home medications. A lot of times the patients aren't eating their own feeds. And so, but you kind of have to be vigilant to look at certain home medications, especially like SSRIs, things that really can't be stopped abruptly, mm-hmm. or you'll have another set of side effects.
Mm-hmm. A lot of complexity, Kenyetta.
It is.
A lot.
But I enjoy it every day.
And I know that in some of the cases that I've been involved in, people from ICU form part of the rapid response team and go out of the unit when there is a crisis on one other part of the hospital. I was sitting in a International Council for Nurses meeting one day in Australia and had a chance to meet the nurse from New Zealand who was instrumental in getting the rapid response team concept formed in her hospital. And then, of course, it spread from there. But for people who are not familiar with that term, can you share with our listener how a rapid response team functions?
So rapid response teams are usually made up of ICU nurses. It can be made up of respiratory therapists, may or may not contain an advanced practice provider, an NP or PA or physician, but essentially they are called to the bedside by either usually the nurse, the primary nurse or the patient. They can also be called by the patient themselves or the family members who are at the bedside of the patient when something just seems off or they notice a change in the patient and you need another set of eyes quickly to come evaluate the patient. And the concept behind that is early intervention can help prevent bad outcomes if things are caught early and intervened early. But they have been crucial to many hospital systems in helping cut down on some hospital-associated events, just because things are called early. Usually the nurses primarily are ICU-based, and some systems have nurses that solely work on the rapid response team, like that is their primary unit, per se, and they tend to follow up quite closely on some patients. Not all patients need to go to the intensive care unit if they have a rapid response call. It just depends upon what the clinical situation is. If the nurses feel that the patient needs a higher level of care, then they tend to just call the critical care service. And then they also come out to evaluate the patient.
Do you encounter nurses who are insecure or apologetic or unsure whether they did the right thing by calling the rapid response team?
Sometimes I do. And I never get upset about it. I tend to think it's better safe than sorry. And sometimes it's just simple things, you know, oh, my patient may be tachycardic, or your patient has a fever and they're probably a little dry, but they have normal blood pressure. And sometimes, you know, the nurses, or I just can't put my finger on it. Something about the patient isn't right. And sometimes right. But we take them all seriously and then we respond appropriately.
We would call that nursing intuition that comes along with being able to do some critical thinking. It was something that when I was in charge of staff development of the hospital's nurses, I would talk with the nurses about the role of intuition and that it comes with experience. And I've seen that in deposition transcripts when nurses are asked, you know, what are the events that led up to this incident? They use the words that you just used, Kenyatta. Something wasn't right. I knew something was wrong. I knew I needed to call the physician. I couldn't put my finger on it, but there was a change in the patient, and I knew that I had to get the patient help. Not knowing what was behind it, but seeing the changes, subtle or overt, in the patient's condition.
I think with the aid of rapid response teams, it has probably cut down on a lot of in-hospital events. Now, not all events can be prevented, but it has cut down.
And then does your team also respond if there is a cardiac arrest? Or is that a different team?
We do. I've worked in several different facilities. So the code team, as they're most commonly called, typically does involve the critical care service. And it can be modeled where there are certain assignments. There can be specific assignments for nurses, such as, you know, you're the recorder, you're the CPR, you're set for CPR. There usually is a pharmacist who attends, and of course a respiratory therapist, an intensivist, and then an advanced practitioner also. But it's a little different depending upon the system, but that's typically how they're made up of. And usually when codes start, they're a little chaotic because everyone's just running to the scene and you're trying to get the story. And when the code teams are very well managed and well seen, the codes run very smoothly. They tend to run better when there's less people. Mm-hmm. Because everyone has a assigned role.
And I think they tend to run better when people are current on ACLS standards and know what they should be doing and what order as well.
Correct. That is correct. Usually most places I've been at, the floor nurses are usually just BLS certified. Mm-hmm. And so they would tend to start, you know, CPR. And then, of course, most critical care, all critical care providers and RTs are ACLS certified. So then you take over.
I'm also curious about the dyad that you're talking about, that you work with a physician. Where does your role end and the physician's role begin?
We tend to work seamlessly as a team. We tend to do things as a team approach. And depending upon the acuity and the busyness of the unit, we focus on the divide and conquer model, to where we split the patients equally, if possible. Sometimes it's just not. And my typical day would be, I kind of like pre-round on all the patients to make sure there aren't any hot spots or fires I need to put out initially. And then I sit and dive, talk to the nurses about the events overnight, go through the labs, the imaging, you know, read through the chart, formulate the plan for the day. Then we do interdisciplinary rounds where it's the pharmacist and the dietitian and the social worker. As we, you know, round through all the patients, kind of honing in on the plan for the day, and then you just document. Usually the physician does come back around just to add something if it needs to be added in the plan, or you can dialogue with them intermittently. If there's something that's quite urgent, you know, they're there. You just stop and discuss and formulate a new plan.
You're ordering meds, right?
Yes.
You're ordering diagnostic tests.
Yes.
You're looking at the results of the tests.
Yes.
And are you diagnosing?
Yes.
And if you're dividing the unit equally, it sounds to me like you are in a physician role. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. Where are the limits of what you are allowed to do by license and what the physician's allowed to do. It sounds to me like your roles are very similar, if not identical. And maybe that's me misunderstanding it.
So one could argue that what we do is very similar, but there are some limitations. In my state, we work under compact agreements between your supervising physicians and your partners within the practice. And so within our agreements, it kind of spells out what you can and cannot do. And then a lot of it also has to do with the credentialing through the hospital. So for instance, we do not intubate or do bronchoscopies, but we do place central lines and vas caps and ART lines, chest tubes. But those kind of things you kind of delineate to the physician, like the intubations. If the patient needs a Swan-Ganz catheter, for example, for measurement of right and left sided pressures, that's tend to done by the physician, not APPs in my particular practice setting. In other practice settings, depending upon the hospital and the system in the state, APPs are allowed to intubate. And some do bronchoscopies, therapeutic bronchoscopies. So it really just depends upon the credentialing at the facility and your agreement with the physician in the state.
It sounds to me, Kenyatta, like the lines between the acute care nurse practitioner and the intensivist have blurred. Is that your perception?
Our roles are very similar. I think a good attribute of any advanced practitioner, whether it's an NP or PA, is to know when you need help and when to call your physician. We do very similar things. Our training, of course, is completely different. And, you know, the basics of pathophias and management really don't change. But because the patients are so complex, sometimes you do need help and you just need to know when you need help.
One of the things that I learned from hanging around the sessions at the International Council of Nurses and in the times that I've presented is that there's been research about the difference between NPs and physicians in terms of patient satisfaction. And NPs, much to the concern of the MDs, always consistently score higher in terms of patient satisfaction with teaching, with dynamics, with the interpersonal aspects. I would imagine you have family members who are coming into the critical care units who need explanations and handholding and reassurance. So I think it's a tribute to us as nurses that the research shows that we score higher on those measures. And you are smiling to indicate to me that you know just exactly what I'm talking about.
I do. You know, I think just because our background, of course, is nursing and our training is different, we do tend to take a little bit more time with families and patients. And because our roles are a little different, my responsibilities are different. So sometimes you're not held to all the extra responsibilities that the physician has. So therefore, I have more time. Research has also shown that nurse practitioners provide just as effective and safe care as physicians. Research has shown that over and over again.
I know that's another finding that some physicians find annoying because they really want to prove that they're superior. And every nurse listening to this program, I'm pretty sure knows what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Well, Go ahead.
I think at the end of the day, the goal is still the same, to provide good care to your patient and hopefully improve the outcome.
And you have an interest in legal nurse consulting and are available to review cases. Can you describe to our viewer or listener what are the things that you would be able to do to help them with their cases or their clients, and then what is the best way for them to be able to reach you?
So I do review records, not necessarily critical care based. but just about any specialty within the hospital, with the exception of peds and OB. Those are not my specialties, and I pass them along as soon as I get them. But whether it's trying to figure out if the standard was met, depending upon the situation, to if you're needing an expert to speak to a nursing matter, or an expert as far as to speak to an NP matter, I do that. And if you're just needing something that's kind of outline the chart chronologies, I'd also do behind the scenes work too. It just depends upon the client's need. But I can be reached. I do have a website, and it is huffmedicalconsulting.com, and Huff is spelled H-O-U-G-H. Or I can be reached at huffmedical@gmail.com.
All right. Perfect. Thank you, Kenyatta, for spending some time helping our viewer understand a little bit more about what goes on in the critical care units. I think we focused a lot on some of the high-risk aspects of care, particularly the medications, the need for a clear, consistent communication and working as a team. You and a physician are paired to work in a unit for a week, so you get to know the patients well, you get to know each other's communication styles well, and you have almost identical responsibilities. There are some things that you don't do, and there are some things that I'm sure the physician doesn't do. We've talked about nurse practitioners being highly regarded in patients' eyes and family eyes for communication skills and providing a safe and effective level of care.
We've talked about a lot, and we've only touched the surface.
That's right. That's right. And this was a fast 30 minutes. We could go into a lot more depth. I appreciate you and you sharing your expertise with our audience. And I appreciate you who is listening to this program on our audio channels or watching it on our YouTube channel, which is Legal Nurse Business. Be sure to go to the YouTube channel and subscribe so you get notified of new videos that are coming out, which are going to be available to you once you're a subscriber, and you'll be informed when there's a new podcast or some of the other shorter videos that I am producing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pat.
Would you like the best of the best Legal Nurse Consulting podcasts? Before I explain how you can get them, here's a tiny bit of background. I'm Pat Iyer. I started Legal Nurse Podcast in September 2016 to bring you tips, inspiration, and new ideas in a new format. I've written a lot of books, and I've taught a lot of courses, but I didn't have a way to reach you through audio. Since 2016, the podcast grew to include guest interviews, a co-host, transcripts, and the video format. When I started the podcast, what I did not expect was the extent of our international audience. My podcast hosting company keeps track of the location of our listeners and the number of downloads. You are part of an international audience. We have listeners in 82 countries. Our top six countries are the US, Japan, Canada, Australia, Germany, and the UK. Our podcasts have been downloaded over 102,000 times. And I know which shows are downloaded the most. That brings me to what I want to announce today. Now available is our newest podcast bundle of top shows. Using the data from our hosting company, I created bundles of top podcasts in six categories: marketing, client relationships, finance, business development, expertise, and stories of successful LNCs. These bundles are found only on my website at podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. Each bundle has the top four shows in that category.
When you go to podcast.legalnursebusiness.com, you'll be able to put in your name and your email address and pick the category of bundle that you are interested in listening to. You'll pick that topic and you'll listen to the four shows in that bundle. You can pick one or more of the topics. You'll also be able to get the deluxe workbook, which has questions to deepen your knowledge and to help you focus on the key points in each of our shows. The workbook also has the full transcripts to enable you to refer to the knowledge we shared without having to re-listen to the show. There's a small investment for the workbook. Thank you for listening to Legal Nurse Podcast and watching it on our YouTube channel at Legal Nurse Business. Your interest keeps my podcast going and growing. And be sure to go to podcast.legalnursebusiness.com to pick your podcast bundles and workbooks to enhance your knowledge. This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. I have with me today Linda Wagoner. Linda is a nurse practitioner who's certified in both medical surgical and psychiatric nursing and combines those two areas of expertise. Linda, can you tell our viewer who's watching this on our Legal Nurse Business YouTube channel or on our audio channels listening to this show, what are some of the highlights of what we covered in your podcast?
Yes, Pat, I think one of the main things that we stressed in our discussion was the prevalence of physical health problems in the mental health population. The fact that they don't get really good care in our system and that they die many years younger on average than people in the general population, largely from the same causes. But they don't get very good care for a number of reasons. Sometimes they have trouble accessing the system, and sometimes our system is not very good at managing chronic health problems. And just the need for the average practitioner to be aware that a high percentage of their population in primary care is going to have some kind of mental health issue, whether it be depression, or bipolar disorder or something else, and that they should be screening for these disorders. And I think most of the doctors are using some questionnaires to screen people. We talked about some of the conditions that can mimic psychiatric conditions, such as arrhythmias, Graves' disease can mimic anxiety. Hypothyroidism can mimic depression. And so there are a number of conditions like that where a person might come in ostensibly for a psych reason, but in reality, they've got something medical going on, or perhaps they have both.
So we're talking about misdiagnosis, delay in diagnosis, failure to diagnose.
Exactly. And also to be very aware of a person's propensity for suicide. If someone is widowed, a male living alone, recently widowed, with a lot of health problems, has a gun in the home, all of those things should be factors that would raise your suspicion that this is somebody who possibly would commit suicide. And we also always have to be aware of that.
Thank you, Linda. We covered a lot in this podcast.
You'll be sure to
listen to this. Psychiatric issues affect all kinds of cases, not just the medical malpractice ones that Linda and I talked about, but they are factors and side effects of serious injury as well, dealing with trauma, chronic pain, changes in body image. There's a whole layer of psychiatric and mental health challenges that affect people who are injured, and an area that doesn't receive a lot of attention. Thank you, Linda, for your participation in this podcast.
Oh, you're welcome, Pat. Glad to be here.
Be sure to look for Linda Wagoner's podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.